This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Genevieve Kosky,
Keith Phipps,
and Tasha Robinson.
On last week's episode, we talked about Terrence Malick's debut feature, Badlands, a period piece about a teenage girl and an older man who go on a shooting spree across the heartland of America. That description more or less applies to the new Luca Guadagnino film, Bones and All, though the two are more like-aged and have a more compelling rationale for killing people. Opening in 1980s Virginia, the film stars Taylor Russell as Marin Yearley, a 17-year-old who lives with her overprotective father in a run-down trailer, only the latest in a long series of different homes. After slipping away for a sleepover one night, Marin surprises her friend and herself by gnawing off most of the girl's finger, realizing a cannibalistic impulse that she had suppressed. On her 18th birthday, her father suddenly abandons her, leaving her a tape recording that explains her condition, which first became apparent to him as early as when she was a toddler. Now left to her own devices, Marin stumbles into another quote-unquote eater, a much older and frightening man named Sully, played by Mark Rylance, who tries to teach her more about her condition. But when she grows suspicious of him, Marin strikes out to the Midwest, where she meets an eater named Lee, played by Timothy Chalamet. The two of them have a strong connection, but their future together and apart is in question. Can they really trust each other? How can they keep doing what they need to do and live with themselves? We'll puzzle through those questions and many more after the break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So you can't spend the night?
Not all night.
So where'd you move here from anyway?
Eastern Shore. Try that.
Dad!
You didn't. When the cops get here, you have to be good and gone.
I can't help you anymore.
I know it's not your fault. You were born this way.
You ate them. I believed you had to. I don't know why.
I smelt you. I didn't know I could do that.
I thought I was the only one. I don't want to hurt anybody.
Famous last words.
Are there lots of us?
I don't actually meet many others.
Why'd you offer to bring me along?
You seem nice.
I am nice.
I came looking for you. I smelled you.
You can smell me half a mile away. Can you do that?
Not that far.
I got rules. Never, never, ever ate an eater. I thought you might be hungry.
For hens?
No.
All right, so I'm super curious because I know what Keith thought of this film because he wrote about it for us, but I wanted to know what everyone else thought of Bones and All.
I saw this movie at Fantastic Fest knowing very little about it. It was well before it was really out there. And the description of it in the program was so elliptical that it kind of read like one of those films that is just becoming more and more common at film festivals that turns out to not really be a horror film, but is something that is trying to be sold a little bit as a horror film in order to get butts in seats. And I was so deliriously happy about the reveal. I kind of regret that we even like brought up what happens in this movie. I tried to avoid that as much as possible, even though it's out there as, you know, the cannibal romance with Timothée Chalamet. It was just, the whole thing was just a voyage of discovery for me. And I really, really enjoyed the process of finding out alongside the characters all of the stuff that they didn't know about, finding out along with them and finding out exactly how much of a horror movie, exactly how bloody and gory this movie is just a complete surprise. I really enjoyed this movie. It's on my top 10 of the year as of this moment. We're still a week out from final voting, and there's a lot left to watch, but that'll just tell you, like, right now, at least in the moment, how I'm feeling about it. I think the performances are great. I think the storytelling is pretty fascinating. I think it's got some of the most exciting cameos I've seen in a movie in 2022. I hope we can talk about those a little bit, but I was very bullish. I'm really curious about how Genevieve took it, considering we kind of talked about her aversion to certain kinds of horror, where this fit in for her.
Yeah, I had like pretty much the exact opposite experience of Tasha as far as like sense of discovery with this movie, because not only did I sort of interview you, Tasha, about Fantastic Fest and listen to what you had to say about Bones and All on a bonus episode over on the Patreon, which if you're not a subscriber, you should subscribe so you can go listen to that. So I heard, you know, a spoiler-free kind of description of what it was. So I had that context. And when we decided we were going to do this pairing, everyone, I think, was lightly concerned for me and how I would handle it, given my noted aversion. But, you know, Scott gave me tips on when to cover my eyes. And for the most part, like I was totally fine with this movie as far as like the quote unquote horror aspects of it. I don't think it's a horror film at all. I agree with you there, Tasha. I think it resists genre. You know, it certainly has moments of gore and shock, which I, you know, was suitably braced for. But in between, it's really kind of it's a coming of age film again, very much, which I tend to like. And I did appreciate it more as a story about Marin than a relationship story. I found myself a little cool on the relationship between her and Lee. I don't know if it's Chalamet, who I wasn't in love with in this role. Like, I think he was fine, but I also feel like many other actors could have done something just as interesting and maybe more so with this role. But Marin's story and that performance and sort of her self-discovery appealed to me a lot more. I thought the character of Sully was 10 times more interesting and terrifying than anything else in the film, and both wanted more of him and also did not want any more of him. I agree that like there's lots of really strong and interesting supporting performances / characters in this movie, and I do think that Marin's story isn't a strong enough backbone to make it a successful film. But I feel that sort of as a, you know, a love story, it didn't quite, you know, reach the highs for me that it maybe did for other people.
I think that's fair to say. I like this film a lot, but the point where Lee leaves, like, in probably like 3/4 of the way through the movie, I actually thought maybe we were done with that character, because mm-hmm. I thought maybe that relationship had run its course. I actually do really like the part at the end, the sort of like, let's be humans for a while section of it.
In Ann Arbor,
but probably filmed in Cincinnati, right?
Yeah.
I think most of the film was. To me, I think that's kind of a problem in the sense that maybe I should not be wanting this to feeling like his work had been done in the story, because it's very much Marin's story in many ways too. But no, I mean, I like this film a lot though. I mean, just the individual, a lot of individual sequences have really stuck with me and found kind of haunting, and you know, just the feel of it, and not to be too, you know, zoomer about it, as I so often am, but it's definitely a mood, you know. It's definitely a mood film, and
you can kind of sink give you the feels.
Aren't you trying to say vibe, Keith? Oh,
all the
film
feels
is a vibe.
All the feels. It's a vibe and a mood, and
all the feels. Yeah, look at those, so many feels.
Yeah,
it's giving
feels.
Mood.
Exactly. I'll be 50 in a couple weeks. I was really quite impressed with this. I think, you know, I guess if we want to get into individual moments a little bit, I mean, yes, Roylance as Sully is kind of amazing because he is terrifying, but he also has this kind of like weird aura of innocence about mm-hmm. him too, you know? Like,
I mean, I was convinced that he was going to be revealed as like a secret good guy up until right. the end.
Right.
Well, not until the end, until he rolled up in the van, I should say.
The role that he ends up taking is kind of a classic good guy, like mm-hmm. in the sense of a right. nice guy. I'm a nice mm-hmm. guy. Like that's mm-hmm. that is very much an archetype he's mining with that role.
I want to come back to him, but I want Keith to finish his thought.
But the other thing is, I think the scene with Michael Stuhlbarg and David Gordon Green.
Oh my God, it's so good.
As the groupies.
As these strange, like, you know, partners in crime. I guess, I don't know how you want to put it. Stuhlbarg is
unbelievable.
Stuhlbarg, man. I mean, Green's good too. But
like, that's like seed of the year level material for me, yes. That specific scene. I think Stuhlbarg is incredible. And I think we need that scene to get a sense of just how extreme this can go. That if you completely lose any sense of morality at all, that you can kind of become what Michael Stuhlbarg is in this
and
scene.
On the complete opposite end of that spectrum, Chloe Sevigny's one scene,
yes.
too, sort of the opposite extreme of where this can go,
right, of just like I have to destroy myself in order mm-hmm. to do the right thing. I mean, that was the thing, and I think this is where I line up a little bit with Genevieve on this movie, is that I like the older people in this movie more than the younger ones in terms of my interest level. I mean, Marin, obviously an interesting character and somebody we can, you know, who leads us through the world of the film quite well, but I really loved the time that we spend with Sully, the scenes with Michael Stuhlbarg and David Gordon Green, and then later with Chloe Sevigny.
And a plum scene with Jessica Harper, too.
Oh, God, yes. I forget. That was so awesome. I did not know she was in that movie. And it was so right. fantastic to see the legend Jessica Harper turn up as well. I thought that all that was really, really good. So I kind of, you know, I didn't want to be like the old guy who likes the old people or whatever in the movie. But that's kind of where I landed. I really liked the time that we spent with them. But there's plenty of other things about the film, I think, to savor. I think its approach to genre, it's kind of upending of genre expectations, which is kind of what he did a little bit with his version of Suspiria, but I think is a little more successful here. And I liked it as a perspective on the American landscape of that period. The music is really cool. I mean, there's a lot of things about this movie that are laudable for sure.
I think also one thing I like about it is when we say how far this will go, it's a kind of a amorphous metaphor, isn't it? Like it's a little bit about addiction. It's a little bit about not being straight, having an outsider sexuality, but not entirely that either. It's kind of just about being an outsider in general. The 80s setting, I think, kind of puts everything into like even sharper relief in some ways. I like the vagueness of it.
It's a little bit about family legacies. It's a little sure. bit about, you know, how your past can haunt you sometimes, even if you don't know your past. But all that said, okay, so remember when we talked about Tar and I was like, but she just lost my sympathy utterly at the Juilliard scene and never got it back. And you all said, what are you talking about? You're not supposed to sympathize with her. You're not supposed to like her. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, I don't think that this is a meant to be a great romance movie. I don't know that I ever thought of that romance as something we were supposed to swoon over or find convincing or be compelled by. I mean, I don't want to get too far into connections already, but I very much saw that relationship in light of the relationship in Badlands. And I think here they're much more sincere about feeling it, about believing it themselves. But they're, again, two very callow people who kind of don't like each other at all at first, and maybe are not either of them all that well suited for romance or connection, but they cling to each other because they have this thing in common. You know, they're both young, they're both eaters, they understand each other, but especially for Marin, I just kind of got a feeling of this might be the only person I could ever have a romance with, because this is the only person I've ever met who's like me and who will understand. I definitely did not feel a connection to this movie as a great romance movie or a tragic romance movie or anything like that. It's kind of a movie about a pair of monsters, a pair of serial killers who are, as Keith said, kind of outsiders and strangers in the world. When you talk about that metaphor for being queer, for being an outsider, to me, it has very much a feeling of the only two queer people in a small town deciding to hook up, because what choice do you have, and trying to make it into a great, great romance, but, you know, never clicking in the way they might do if they had more choices.
I mean, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I agree. I think it is a relationship of survival more than anything else. I do think maybe this film is being marketed as a romance a little bit.
This film is definitely being marketed in ways that have nothing to do with
exactly,
what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
In the way, again, of films being marketed as horror adjacent when they aren't, or horror films being marketed as, you know, exciting, scary, jump scare movies with a monster when they're really like psychological explorations.
Right. But I want to go back to what you said about this being a couple of serial killers, because like, is Marin a killer? I don't think she ever actually kills. And this is what I wanted to get into with Sully, is sort of that first extended interaction we get with them. Like, I read that as the film telling us like this character does not kill. This character is a scavenger, basically. And it sort of seemed like he was being presented as an option to live this life without killing. And then Lee comes in and is a killer. But I could be forgetting something, but I don't know that we ever get confirmation that Marin participates willingly in any of that. She definitely looks on during that kill of the carnival worker, but she's very upset by the discovery that follows that. So she's not like, again, not to get into connections too soon, but she does have this sort of like passive amorality that Holly has as well in Badlands.
I mean, it sure doesn't stop her from eating that dude, and it sure doesn't turn her away from the relationship or persuade her to go elsewhere or break with him. And, you know, in fact, they kind of become more passionate and closer as a couple after that murder. I think it's fair, I suppose, to say she isn't a serial killer, but she's, you know, she's absolutely an accomplice to a serial killer. And while it may shock her, it also seems to kind of excite her. I think that she is excited by his confidence and worldliness. And I think that this is, in a way, a vampire movie, you know, a ghoulish and gruesome vampire movie that really deals with the flesh a lot more than vampire movies normally do. But it's still about, you know, creatures who are essentially predators. In this case, they have the option to not murder people. And, you know, she still goes along with it and seems more or less fine with it.
Do they have the option? I mean,
they have the option that Rylance's character, that Sully, lays out.
Yeah, but he does it. But that's revealed to be a lie, though. Like the whole thing at the beginning where he can kind of like sense when someone's dying and then sort of wait on it. That's kind of a reveal that's kind of a bit of nonsense at the end. Yes.
Is it? I mean, yeah. I don't know.
I didn't catch that. Where did you see that, Scott?
I don't know.
I mean, he certainly like is revealed to be a bad guy.
I thought maybe
he does try to kill at the end, but that seems, I took that as kind of like out of character. I think that character is, I think being a kind of human vulture, circling the dying, kind of fits that character. But you know,
it's a much more ethical way of mm-hmm. eating people than straight up murdering them. You know, just like having that ability to sense when they're going to die, and then feasting. It's not a there's a pretty strong moral distinction to be made between doing that and then kind of targeting someone and you know, murdering them in a cornfield.
I mean, I definitely took him to be, you know, presenting an option. So it's starker, it's highlit in a much starker way when we see Marin going along with Lee's murder and accepting the fact that he kills people. I mean, she doesn't seem all that particularly shocked when they first meet and he's covered in the blood of a fresh kill that he invites her to partake of, if I recall correctly.
So one thing I want to kind of get your guys' thoughts on as far as like Lee's kills, because that kill was the guy from the convenience store, right? Mm-hmm. That's what yes. And then the carnival worker was the other one. And, you know, the carnival worker is revealed to be like a family man. And that is like a big turn. But before that, we have a like sort of longish scene of Lee watching him from afar, kind of like just being a dick to a kid, you know? And it seemed like they were like the film is trying to establish some sort of like morality or rule that Lee has about like only killing quote unquote bad people. But also, like, I feel like that is all tied up in the question of how much they actually need to eat. Like, we talked a little bit how there's a loose addiction metaphor here, but like, you know, as opposed to something like vampirism, I don't think we get any indicator that like eaters can't survive if they don't eat.
In Ann Arbor, they seem to be perfectly healthy, not eating. Like, yeah. the whole let's be humans for a while thing. It seems that they can live this existence without
right
eating.
So that like undercuts any sort of like ethics that Lee has.
When they first meet, though, Lee gives her a whole speech about how like now that she's started, it's going to be something that she needs to do or she's going to die, how it's going to get, because she kind of underlines the fact that she's 18 and she's gone this long without eating much human flesh. Mm-hmm. And he tells her that it's just going to get worse and worse, like the older she gets, and she's going to have to do it and have to do it more and more often. Mm-hmm. Whether right. the live like humans thing means he was lying about that or he was just speaking from his own cravings is, I think, not something we fully get clarity on.
This is adapted from a novel, a YA novel, which I haven't read, by Camille DeAngelis. And in that, last episode we had referenced an interview that the screenwriter David Kajanik recently did with Film Spotting, and there's a really interesting detail which everyone listening should go listen to this interview. It's pretty interesting, but he talks about adaptation in general and what it's like to work with authors and what it's like to adapt a film. But he talks about how DeAngelis told him there was one subtext that she really had to have in the movie that was just central to her conception of what this work was all about and he could not lose, and that was veganism. And I've been thinking about that ever since, because I don't see it. But you know, she has a whole essay on her website about veganism and cannibalism and why a vegan would write this book. So you know, and honestly, I think you can. That's a layer you can add in there if you want. I think that's part of why this film is effective. Is like, sure, it's about veganism too. Let's just throw that into the mix. You know,
this reminds me of the Simpsons propaganda video where it's like this cow will kill you and everyone you care about. How is that even worked in? I mean, other than just implied by the whole as just being more of a vegan friendly movie somehow.
I mean, the whole movie is about consumption and the price that you pay for eating meat, like the price that you set for yourself in terms of how far you're willing to go for it, like whether you consider the ethical question or not.
The moral compromise. Yeah,
the fact that there are still levels and degrees of it. But in the end, there's not that much separating Marin and Lee from Sully, from Michael Stuhlbarg and David Gordon Green's characters, Brad and Jake. There's, when it comes right down to it, no matter who's eating and what they did to get it, it's portrayed as pretty disgusting. You know, the fact that they drive away from that cornfield kill just soaked in blood and are making no effort whatsoever to clean it up, I think is pretty significant. The fact that this movie is not like horror movie gory in most senses, but it does just completely leave the characters soaked in blood literally every time they eat. That seems significant from a vegan point of view. Yeah. Just like it's a big symbol.
Here is part of DeAngelis's essay, and it's pretty persuasive, I think. She's referring to the book, not the film, but here's the thing about Marin, my anti-heroine. She, quote, does the bad thing despite her very best intentions. She wants real friends and a real home, real love, but this horrible compulsion traps her in an endless cycle of devouring and remorse. It's our best intention to nourish our families when we sit down to a meal together, and yet we prepare and serve the food with little, if any, thought given to who that food used to be, whom it was taken from, how many beings had to suffer for your steak, your wings, your macaroni and cheese. You just want to feed your children, right? Well, so do they.
Boy, that's heavy. It is very much baked into the meat of this movie, I have to say. But it's certainly a heavy thing to be considering about, like, what feels like a story about what feels like a monster movie in some ways, and a romance movie in some ways, and a coming of age movie in some ways. Like, that is a big, heavy, harsh theme that I definitely can see where she's coming from.
Well, I'm glad that we've talked about the vegan component of Bones and All, because I have a feeling that's one thing that is not coming up during Connections. So we'll be right back to make some of those.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I thought I was the only one. Are there lots of us?
Not lots, but more than you'd think. You've met a few, sure, that you know of. You never had anyone take an interest in you? A double take?
Just always thought.
You just thought some people are creepy. It's better if we all steer clear of one another. We're dangerous to non-eaters, but we can hurt one another just as bad. I hope you're hearing me on this.
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Tasha, this was your idea, right? These two, pairing these two films, because you had seen this one, the Bones and All, at Fantastic Fest, is that right?
It was my idea that we should take up Bones and All, because I kind of thought that you specifically would dig it, and it might be a rare case where we were both in accordance, in part because it is such a Badlands-like film, and you're such a lover of that movie and of Malick, and in part because it combines, you know, some of your favorite things, including gory, gory violence, and just like imagistic filmmaking, and also in some cases, like the kind of like long sitting with a thought or a mood that I associate with a lot of the movies that you love.
Tasha,
like,
you're thinking of me. That's
this
so nice.
Feels a little bit like Nomadland with a whole lot more corpse eating.
Okay.
But I'm not sure whether I was the one that suggested Badlands. I kind of feel like I wasn't.
No. Well, we were, because you were the only one that had seen it. You were like, it's kind of like Bonnie and Clyde, but not really.
I may have just said it's a young lovers on the run movie.
Right. And then I was like, what about Badlands?
And then I was immediately like, that's exactly
that's it.
Yeah.
Good job. Good job, everyone. So we know one of our process. Tasha, do you want to start us off with a connection here?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about both of these movies' use of voiceover, because voiceover is such a signature for Malick that it's become almost a joke. You know, by the time you get around to Knight of Cups and it's just wall to wall, somebody like whispering ASMR style in your ear about the world, it just feels more like an in-joke than anything else. But in Badlands, that idea was pretty young and unformed, and it's something he was kind of experimenting with. Sissy Spacek's voice in your ear, just kind of telling you what you're seeing on screen and what it means in a way that you might not access if you were just watching the images. Like you might be tempted to take this relationship as something deeper and more old school cinematic, more Bonnie and Clyde like, if you didn't have her voice constantly reminding you that she's very young and very naive and not really taking in the consequences of what she's experiencing in a way that an older or more mature character might. So I find it really ironic and funny that Bones and All, which just seems in so many ways to owe so much to Malick and Badlands, has its own form of voiceover, but it's not the main character constantly whispering in your ear about what she thinks and feels. It's Andre Holland as her father explaining her history to her through this audio tape that he leaves for her, which she rations out to herself in a cinematic device that if it was done less well, I would find it like artificial and annoying. I'm usually not a big fan of voiceover, but the way she holds on to this tape as the last remnant of her relationship with her father, and is this kind of Pandora's box filled with truths that kind of horrify her and that shed more light on who she is and who she was. The way she kind of doles it out to herself, like both a special little treat and like something she has to brace herself to face every time, and the way it weaves itself into the structure of the movie and becomes this sort of careful parsing out of information, but also leaves you with these just beautiful images of like her on the bus listening to a little segment of this tape and getting a little more of the story, for instance. I loved that aspect of it. I think that just the way these movies both use voiceover is very different tonally and structurally and conceptually. But the fact that they both have that in common, I think is just kind of fun.
I find it really interesting that you read it. And to be clear, I don't think there is a right or wrong way to read it. But I find it interesting that you saw that as her actually doling that tape out to herself little by little, rather than that just being how the film presented it to us. Because I kind of saw it as something that she was listening to over and over and over again, obsessively, and we were just dropping in with her, you know, sort of as a filmmaking narration technique. I think it, either way it works, you know. Like I said, I don't think there's a right or wrong way to read that, but it does, you know, color the character's journey a little differently, I think.
Ooh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I completely agree with Genevieve's kind of read on it, on that, the action. I feel like she would have listened to the tape in full, and that we're, and that the film is parsing that out, that narration, you know, to places that we need it. And then, you know, because then you get to that moment where she finally destroys the tape, and I think it's certainly implied, not that she has reached the end of that tape for the first time, but that she is letting go of this. You know, I mean, she needs to destroy it. I think she goes back to the tape because she needs to have that sense of protection of that, you know, that is what all that she has left of her father. And surely there's a certain amount of comfort to that, because, you know, he'd been protecting her for so long.
Tasha, I saw it your way.
Ooh.
This is a rare case where I don't feel that one of those answers is right or wrong. I think that that's a really cool interpretation. I want to keep it my way because I like the interiority of, as I say, you know, both bracing herself and like looking forward to the next little bit of it. But I agree that there's no evidence, and it would make a lot of sense if she's listening to this tape over and over. But Keith, I appreciate the support.
I want to stick up for Malick's narration throughout his career a little bit here, and actually one of my favorite things I ever did at the Dissolve was a video with Kevin B. Lee put together, and I wrote and narrated about the use of narration and Malick's films and how it evolved over time. And I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things about this film and Days of Heaven as well is that made the narration exciting is just being inside the head of someone who isn't a conventional person, who has weird thoughts. You know, I think that one of the problems that narration often causes is that it becomes kind of a narrative patch in itself, not that compelling. You're not really getting, you know, an additional quality. You're just kind of like, you know, gluing the film together in a way. But here it's a little different. You know, and also I think the other important point with Malick is that And with other filmmakers, Scorsese too, who uses a lot of narration, is that narration frees the camera. It frees you up to do a lot of images, because you're not kind of pinned down by having to have everything in the dialogue. But as far as, you know, the Malick's later films, I mean, they became, you know, he would have, you know, like a chorus of narrators, like in The Thin Red Line, or his narration would get a little bit, I would say, more philosophical or spiritual in a film like Knight of Cups, not self-parody.
Unnecessary, goofy, overdone.
No, not at
repetitious.
All. Because again, you're getting these extraordinary images. So anyway, but I think the important sort of relevant part of Badlands is just kind of locking into this perspective, this way of looking on the world from Holly, that's very innocent and strange and kind of half formed. That is an interesting perspective on the world, and it's all very poetically rendered in that film.
Is it fair to say that the narration in Badlands is occasionally and maybe unintentionally humorous? Did anyone else find it?
Sure. Look at the part where he goes, he just told me to enjoy the scenery, and it's like in the dullest stretch of America that you've ever been.
Right. And humor is just like something I don't really associate with Malick ever. I don't know. He just doesn't seem like a really like gag driven guy. Maybe.
Homer type of thing.
Maybe. So that's an interesting element of the Badlands narration to me, because it is unexpected. And like I said, it feels like maybe unintentional, or maybe it's not like intended as humor so much as sort of like irony, but because of the tone of the rest of the film, it just like registers as very funny. I don't know. Which is to say, the Bones and All narration, not funny at all. I don't think there's any humor in there. No. But there, like all the humor in the film, I think, comes from Lee, pretty much.
Yeah, not funny at all. But that said, just shout out to Andre Holland, who, mm-hmm. while we were exulting over all of the cameos in this film, we kind of gave him short shrift. And I think he just does such a wonderful job with this role that's just so complex, in terms of he's not in the film for very long, but he has to bring across this pretty layered, nuanced combination of fear of her and fear for her, you know, this giant burden that's landed on him, and his sympathy for her, and yet, you know, he also wants to escape, and very reasonably so. I think there's a worn downness to the character that he plays, just from everything he's been through and everything he's suffered through, specifically because of Maren. And it's just so common to see stories like this, you know, about somebody who escapes a sad or oppressive home situation as soon as they possibly can. It's usually not the parent who's the one running away from home with relief.
The like years of weariness on his face are remarkable. I mean, he really does. Without, obviously, you get dialogue. You get a lot of dialogue from him explaining what happened, but you can kind of see it anyway. You know, this is someone who really can't do this anymore.
Yeah. You know, one of the things these two movies have in common, one of the more prominent things, is this idea of the Lovers on the Lamb movie. And I think that both of these films approach it, that idea, from a, you know, it, almost upend the idea of it, you know, because I think that we see a Lovers of the Lamb movie, passion seems to be the driver of the action, that maybe the thrill of criminality, like Gun Crazy or something like that, where it's just like you're really, you know, being together and having all this romantic passion and committing violence, there's a heat to it that isn't necessarily present in either one of these movies, you know, because you have this sort of drift in this relationship between Holly and Kit. And then you have the relationship between Maren and Lee. It comes a little bit later than you might expect. And it's ambiguous in terms of their, you know, feelings for each other, because they don't know the degree to which they can even trust each other or like each other or any of that stuff. And so these are movies that present themselves as being part of that tradition in American movies, but both of them also kind of defy it as well.
Yeah, in really fun ways. I feel like what defines both of these relationships more than passion, more than the sense of a great tragic romance for the ages, is just the sense of poverty and desperation. Like, there's a class element in both of these films that just really speaks to how few options all of these young lovers have. We kind of see that all of them are living in fairly broken down places and under not the best circumstances, to a degree where they look on people who have more than them with like a sense of sort of shock and confusion, almost more than jealousy. But these are all people who come from like working class, like lower working class, impoverished working class surroundings and backgrounds. And they just don't have a lot of resources when it comes to setting out on the run. Their relationships are kind of defined by lack of choice. And then their journeys are defined by lack of choice because they just don't have the option to throw money at a problem as it is. They have the option to sleep in the back of a truck or sleep in a house that they've made in a tree because they're just, they're have-nots.
They're also all orphans to some extent or another, or at least without parent figures. But before we leave this connection, I do really quickly want to jump back to the first part of this when we were talking about how it, Bones and All, is not really a love story. And again, while I agree with that, I do want to know then how you, Tasha, or anyone else reads the final shot of Bones and All, of the two of them naked against a very Malickian backdrop, presumably having just made love. I don't know. Like, that is what we are left with in this film. So how does that inform this relationship?
I mean, for me, huge spoiler, if you haven't seen Bones and All, I don't know how else to discuss this, but I would skip over this bit if you haven't seen it and you're planning on seeing it. I think of that as Marin looking back on a more innocent time, on a brief moment in her life when she had something that she doesn't have now and may never have again. Not because there isn't somebody else out there in the world for her, but just because, again, her choices are limited, and she's not the person that she was when she was with Lee. She's not the person she was certainly when she met Lee. So there's that kind of sense of, you know, that we talked a lot about the Edenic qualities of Malick movies and Malick romances, and the Edenic qualities of Kit and Holly living in the forest together in this like little unspoiled place that they've built for themselves. I think that that's extremely Nomadland shot of Marin and Lee out on the prairie, just with the big open sky behind them, holding each other with their clothes on earlier in the film, and then echoed late in the film, is just kind of a reminder of like they did have their own sort of little Eden, whether it was a great romance for the ages, whether they were right for each other. And that moment doesn't matter. She's looking back on something that she had that's gone now. And, you know, I think that all of us can have nostalgia for the idealized parts of our past, like even if those parts were not necessarily convincing to other people or necessarily the healthiest places in our lives as well.
I think also, not to contradict myself, but I do feel like that final stretch is a lot more romantic. I feel like their relationship is kind of different after they're reunited and after she learns more about his past. There's kind of like more of a connection, a more emotional intimacy between the two of them too. So it can kind of feel like, you know, after that, you know, horrific slash, you know, kind of weirdly beautiful final scene between the two of them, you know, it seems like a good grace note to end this on.
Yeah, I do like that reading of it a lot, Tasha. And I guess I just bring it up here as sort of, I guess, a point of contrast to the way that Badlands ends, with some very just sort of pretty straightforward narration, like, I got married to the son of the lawyer who defended me, and he got the electric chair, and that's it. Yeah, you know, like, it doesn't have that, you know, that grace note, like Keith said, like, purposely so, like, that's not a flaw at all. But I think it does speak to a strain of real romanticism, not in the sort in the broad sense of the word, in Bones and All, that is less present in Badlands, especially as it goes on.
I strongly agree with you there, Keith, about the feeling of the romance between them just being very different at the point where they've settled down in a home where they're not lovers on the run anymore, to tag into the connection that we're talking about, where they've made a home for themselves and they're trying to live as humans. I feel like they're growing in a maturity that Kit and Holly don't necessarily get to have. When he says to her at the car, I'm going to go back to this line again because it was just so striking to me. He says, you know, it's too bad about your father. Someday we're going to have to sit down and have a long talk about that. And he's imagining a future for the two of them where they acknowledge things that they've never acknowledged before. Like, they had plenty of time sitting around that they could have talked about him murdering her father in order to shut off her choices and send her on the run. And they never did talk about it. But he's teasing at a more mature relationship that he imagines they could have one day. I think Marin and Lee do actually push in the direction of that. And we don't get enough of it to see exactly how far they've gotten into it. But I do agree that it does feel like more of a romance by the end.
So Genevieve, do you have a connection for us here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we've already touched on to some degree throughout this conversation, so we don't need to spend too much time on it. But I want to talk about specifically Lee and Kit as sort of charismatic killer figures. I'm struck by the fact that they are both pretty small men physically. Lee even has a line about, like, when you're 140 pounds soaking wet, you need to have a big attitude or something like that. And Kit certainly seems to have a strain of that as well. But, you know, we also talked about toward the end where he's sort of charming all the cops that brought him in and giving away mementos. And even before that, in the cop car, you know, he gets them to say he looks like James Dean. You know, he does have the ability to turn on the charm. And, you know, presumably that's how he gets Holly to begin with, although their courtship is very strange. But in Lee's case specifically, like, his charisma feels directly linked to his ability to kill. Again, I'm thinking of the carnival workers specifically there. Kit's charisma feels more like accidental. Like, we already talked about how he's weird, you know, like, but they both seem to be able to turn it on when the situation calls for it. But they are both clearly, like, damaged men at heart that don't who aren't actually as appealing and likable as they are able to present themselves being.
I found myself thinking, perhaps unfortunately, with Kit of the Onion headline, totally hot chick, also way psycho, which is that applies to that character as well.
I mean, you know, they both kind of project a certain sense of danger, and that's part of the appeal, right? I mean, that is the. There's an excitement that they radiate, the fact that they're bad boys, basically. They're very bad boys. They kill.
Do you see how ripped Lee's jeans are? My goodness.
Did you see how ripped Martin Sheen is as a 31-year-old? There's a lot of shirtlessness in that movie that's kind of just about, like, look how young and muscular this kid is.
Yeah.
Kid. He was 31. Like he's 25 in the movie, not really a kid. He's 31 in real life, not really a kid.
I still think he plays real young. Yeah, I mean, Timothy Chalamet is 26, you know, and he definitely is able to play quite young seeming in this too. But I think that's kind of maybe part and parcel of this weird charisma that they both have. It's like they present young, but they manipulate like a much older man can.
Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't play as young to me as Kit. Like, Kit, there's a naivete to him that partially comes from him being a sociopath, but just partially comes from a feeling that we don't know much about his past, but there's a sense of, like, maybe he never had a childhood, or maybe he never grew out of the mm-hmm. childhood, but he can still get drawn so easily into a dirt clod fight or, you know, pouting because he does something poorly in front of Holly and she sees him and it just makes him turn on her. By comparison, I feel like Lee feels like he's lived in the world a lot more.
Yeah.
Maybe just because, you know, he's literally had to go out hunting for food. We don't even know how long, his entire life. And the fact that we haven't talked at all about his relationship with his sister, who he definitely kind of has an older brother mentor, like cool, distant figure who blows in and out of her life. She actually plays a lot like Holly to me, just in terms of naive girl who is very pretty clearly bored and sees him as just like the kind of cool figure in her life who's going off and doing stuff where she doesn't get to. She's a fun character in a lot of ways. She comes with some fun surprises. But in some ways, the way she plays so young makes him seem just a little older by comparison.
Yeah, that's true. I was about to say that both Kit and Lee, you know, are paired with girls who are, you know, sort of symbolic of innocence to varying degrees. I still think of that scene at Kato's house where Kit and Kato are drinking beer and Holly is drinking a glass of milk, just very drawing a very clear line there. So there is sort of this like innocence versus experience dichotomy with both of these pairs, which was another connection we were going to touch on, but we may as well just mention it here. But that's interesting because I didn't think of Lee's sister in that, and she is sort of another element that maybe sort of amplifies Lee's sense of being like more experienced and world weary.
There's a lot going on in Bones at All. one last thing I think we should probably touch on before piecing out of the connections here has to do with violence. So the justifications for violence in both of these movies, because it's something that the characters, particularly the women, give a lot of thought to it, a lot of thought to like what the violence that they're witnessing and the violence to which they're somewhat participating in, etc. How do you think that all sort of shakes down?
I think it's a pretty solid connection because I think in each in their own way, Lee and Kit both see what they're doing as necessary. Like with Kit, it's like, you know, it's us or them, you know, we need to do this, you know, to avoid capture, even though I think he's taking, especially with that couple that he put in the cellar and a few other, and the rich man and so on, those seem to be like real, he takes pleasure in those. But I think it's at least as far as what he says to Holly, that has to be done. And Lee sees what he is doing as, you know, necessary for survival. And I guess, you know, that's one of the mysteries of the film is like, is it, or is it something else too? But, you know, I think both have really, the heroines of these films meet them at a point where they've already justified their way of looking at the world to themselves. Even if Kit hasn't killed anybody at that point, he's already a killer. I mean, in his mind, he's already fully capable of doing what he does for the rest of the film. And Lee has already been living this way for a while.
I think an interesting contrast between them, though, is like Lee feels that he needs to kill to survive, and he seems to only kill people that he's identified as jerks.
I don't know about the carnival worker, though. I mean, that's to me, there's nothing jerkish about that guy. That's the one.
But we see him kind of antagonizing that little kid, though,
like okay. Just being a snot. No, I mean,
okay,
that's not a reason for killing somebody.
I mean, it's a reach. It's a reach on Lee's part. Like, I think we were supposed to get the sense that he is looking for a justification.
Yeah.
And finding it.
And that's also a question is, like, you know, how much pleasure he's taking in that sexual encounter, which seems to be considerable, too. You know, it's another bit of ambiguity in that film.
Yeah, and it's a question of, you know, whether he's taking pleasure in it purely as sex or whether he's taking pleasure in... I guess this is a very thin line to split, but like, is it about the sexual release or is it about the control? You know, mm-hmm. Is it about successfully seducing somebody into this moment and the power that he has there? Or is it more about the anticipation of a good meal? Like, it's a complicated thing. compared to, but it's definitely something that he's thought through, that we may not know exactly like where all of the little levers and dials dial up to on the range of pleasure of control and pleasure of killing and pleasure of sex and pleasure of like a good fresh meal. But he's thought about it and he seems to know, whereas Kit seems to just kill on impulse and then tells a story afterward about how he had to do it. You know, with the father, it's leaving the recording that says, you know, I want you to know he was antagonizing me when I shot him. Mm-hmm. Later, when he shoots all of the bounty hunters in the back, we get the story of how, well, it was okay for me to shoot them in the back, even though that's not sporting, because they weren't law enforcement agents who were doing a job. They were just people out for the reward money, which he bases on a line that he says he heard one of them say that we never hear. So there's a question of whether he's convincing himself or he's just trying to convince Holly. Either way, he comes up with some sort of story.
And Holly is trying to
done.
Convince us through narration, like she's justifying for him.
Is she, or is she just reporting back? Like, again, yeah. her lack of interiority and kind of vapidity in some cases make me think she maybe is just saying, okay, and then he said this. But given her move towards like just weariness with Kit and with life with Kit over the course of the movie, and given some of her editorializing about, God, this guy's trigger happy. I wonder if when she's saying, you know, and then he said he had to shoot them because they said they wanted money and it's justified because they weren't cops. I wonder if she's already working her way towards, this is what he said. I don't know that that's how I feel about it.
I think at that point, she's still like in the parroting stage, mm-hmm. But it's also like kind of unclear, nor does it need to be clear, like at what point this narration is taking place, like if it's simultaneous with the events that are happening or if it's looking back on it, you know, because I don't recall any lines that indicate that she is like necessarily remembering this from a great distance, I guess at the very end when she says she got married, but I don't know. There's no like real self-reflection in that narration. So it's really hard to tell to what degree she is, I guess, interrogating any of what he says to her in the moment.
Good Lord, Genevieve, I just got done watching this film and now you make me want to go back and rewatch it and see is this whole thing just like her deposition down the line to somebody who she's like describing what happens?
It's all in past tense.
Gonna have to watch it all again.
There's a whole story also in the I married the son of my defense attorney too. You know, there are several points along the way here we really need to know if we were understanding what happened, you know?
Badlands 2. Get on it, Malik.
Badlands 2. Oh, before we leave Badlands, I had to point out Martin Sheen, Dayton's own, Pride Dayton, Ohio. We're proud of our native son.
Thank you for that, Keith.
And his many, many murders of people who he justifies killing.
He's been benevolent and things. So the Next Picture Show listener can wrestle with the ambiguities of these films on your own time. Badlands is available on Criterion DVD and Blu-ray and rentable through the usual platforms. Bones and All is currently in theaters. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. For this particular Your Next Picture Show, we're going to do a cannibalism round robin, I think is how we're calling it. Recommend various cannibal entertainment. It's just, we can't, there are just
a
so many.
A buffet of cannibalism stories.
I love it.
And so we end as we began with
we tried.
Dad joke level
cannibal
humor.
We kept it under wraps for a while. So who wants to start here?
I'll start out with like a distant memory that of a film I have not seen in years, but I remember fondly, even though I apparently no one else does. But that's Bob Balaban's directorial debut, Parents, which I think went direct to video in the 80s or played briefly in some cities. I know I saw it on VHS. It's sort of a, well, what is this? Let's watch it. It is a film set in the 1950s, starring Randy Quaid and Mary Beth Hurt as the titular parents who are cooking up something that their son only becomes grimly, you know, slowly becomes aware of their grim habits. I remember thinking this was pretty good stuff, and it's pretty clever. It's definitely pouring on the sort of the high 50s, the dark side of American suburbia elements of it, but stylishly done. I don't know if I saw it now. Who knows? Maybe I should revisit it. But I was quite fond of that film at the time. Oh yeah, the secret is they're cannibals.
I think we got that, didn't we?
Genevieve, how about you?
Well, I'm going to take us briefly away from movies to talk about two other sort of cannibalistic-centric pieces of culture, one of which is a TV series, a quite popular TV series that you likely have seen, which is called Yellow Jackets on Showtime. First season aired last year, and second season should be coming in the first half of 2023. We talked about it on a Patreon episode on TV We Liked last year. So I won't spend too much time on it, but it is sort of a survival narrative told on two timelines, one of which is in 1996, when a high school girls soccer team, their plane crashes in the wilderness, and we are led to believe that during their time there, they turn to cannibalism to survive. And we do see early on some glimpses of that happening, but the circumstances surrounding it are sort of the big mystery of this series. And it has not been revealed yet. It is still pretty early in the show's run. And there's another timeline in the present day starring Melanie Lynskey, Juliette Lewis, Christina Ricci, Tawny Cypress as sort of grown versions of these characters wrestling with what they did in their time in the wilderness. So it's a great show, very exciting show. If you haven't watched it, I would suggest binging it before season two. And then I just briefly want to recommend a podcast episode, an episode of the podcast You're Wrong About, which is very good if you haven't checked it out before. It sort of considers people or events in the public imagination and recontextualizes them for us. And episode from about a month or so ago was on Flight 71. It's called Survival in the Andes, and it is the story of the Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 that crashed in the Andes in 1972. And the survivors famously had to turn to cannibalism to survive. This was the story of the film Alive, which I am not recommending here. It's a pretty well-known story, but I enjoyed this episode of the podcast for taking it apart from sort of the memoirs of the survivors and really grappling with how they felt about and how they considered what they had to do to remain alive for months in the Andes in the winter, and how they kind of recontextualize cannibalism in terms of their religion. And it's a interesting way to think about cannibalism that I can't think of any other story that sort of reckons with it in that way. So it's called Flight 71, Survival in the Andes, of the podcast You're Wrong About. And Scott, bring us back to a movie.
Okay, well, I have to bring us back to the Claire Denis film, Trouble Every Day. This is a film that was trashed by everyone but me when it was screened, and now everybody likes it. I always have to say that. I actually recently wrote a new cult canon entry for it on our newsletter, The Reveal. This is a film that she made in the early 2000s after Beau Travail, and it's about the aspect, this desire to consume flesh is eroticized in a very Claire Denis-like fashion, and it has a different kind of quality than Bones and All. It's really about this, I guess, sort of a medical experiment gone wrong, or some piece of medicine that they couldn't control that some of the characters have used, this experimental medicine, and they're trying to figure out a solution to it. But in the meantime, this recently married person played by Vincent Gallo, and also this wife of a doctor played by Beatrice Dahl, are you know, they're feasting a little bit. And it's a film of startling bloodshed. I think a lot of people were turned off by how graphic a film it is. But I think over time, you know, and certainly since people have gotten to know and respect Denis's work, they, you know, it's been kind of a piece with the type of desire that she's depicted in other films like Friday Night and 35 Shots of Rum. So if you're a fan of hers, I would have a strong stomach, I would definitely check it out because I think it's a really good movie. Tasha, what about you?
Well, y'all sprung this idea on me like moments ago, and I was kind of prepared to do this like big comedy thing about like all of the cannibal movies. I haven't seen Bone Tomahawk. I haven't seen We Are What We Are. I did not care for The Bad Batch at all, and I can't recommend it. I was eventually going to land on The Platform, one of my favorite films of the last 10 years. It's streaming on Netflix. I still think it's just one of the most innovative like science fiction horror films I've seen in a long time. But it feels like a bit of a cheat because it's not really a cannibal movie so much as a movie that's got some cannibalism in it. Although it does have the distinction of cannibalism of a person who is still alive and present for said cannibalism. Something it shares with Hannibal, for instance, a movie I do not recommend. But I was going to skip across stuff like, you know, Cannibal the Musical, the early Trey Parker film is very messy, but it's got its joys, particularly with just like an early raw version of his musical comedy in particular. And I could say some positive things about Delicatessen, the Marc Caro Jean-Pierre Jeunet film, which also kind of sloppy in a way, but just like a really weird, joyous movie. But while I was looking through all of this, I remembered Ravenous, which is Antonia Bird's 1999 film about the American West and cannibalism there. And it's kind of playing a little bit off the Donner Party situation and sort of the myth and legend of that and how it's kind of come down to us as this sort of true American horror story. Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle star in this movie. David Arquette's in it. Jeffrey Jones is in it, of all people. It's a strange thing to look back on as a movie from 1999, like full of figures you don't see enough of anymore. And then there's also Jeffrey Jones who's in it. But the...
Yeah, we probably see it enough of Jeffrey Jones.
Yeah, I would say so.
The off-screen stuff is not so great.
The elements of this story, you know, it's an indie cannibal western. It's pretty raw in some places. It's pretty shoestringy in some places, but the structure of it is pretty interesting. And the discoveries that you make over time about what cannibalism is and what it means in what becomes almost as much of a fantasy fairy tale story as a horror story, I think are really interesting. And then just kind of the choices, the ethical and moral choices that it gets into about cannibalism and survival, I think go really well with Bones and All. I think you could plausibly convince yourself that they're set in the same universe. I think that you could plausibly convince yourself that they make a good double. But also, I just remember it as a really surprising fun time and a really surprising little cult film. So yeah, Antonio Bird's Ravenous. I will throw that one up there.
Another new cult canon entry.
Film, really?
That I did not like when it came out, and then everyone talked. You know, became such a kind of a cult favorite, and I rewatched it and appreciated it quite a bit.
I didn't like it when it came out, and I am never wrong. I will never revisit this film. I will never reassess my opinion of it.
Well, see, now I don't want to revisit it because now I'm afraid that since I liked it the first time, I won't like it the second time.
I'm sorry. I need to just jump in really quick because Tasha reminded me of something that I would never forgive myself if I talked about a cannibal TV show and did not mention Hannibal, the television show,
not
the film by Brian Fuller. We don't need to get into it, but I'm also going to just throw that out. Hannibal.
Mads Mikkelsen. We love it.
Yep.
Well, that's it for this edition of The Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with a new pairing. Genevieve, want to set us up for our episodes releasing on December 20th?
Last year, Rian Johnson retweeted a TCM preview of 1973's The Last of Sheila, writing, quote, "Fantastic 70s whodunit written by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins, and pretty much the reason I'm in Greece right now," end quote.
That was in July of 2021, when Johnson was indeed in Greece, where he also happened to be filming Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery, the new sequel to his smash hit that introduced Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc to the pantheon of silver screen sleuths. We discussed Knives Out back in 2019 in relation to Johnson's debut feature, Brick, by way of considering his tendency to upend conventional mystery narratives. So this time, we're zeroing in on Johnson's own stated inspiration point to see how The Last of Sheila gave rise to The Glass Onion.
For now, we welcome your feedback on both Badlands and Bones and All, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Genevieve?
I am still the TV editor at Vulture, still not really writing much, and still not really tweeting much on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. But I'm working really hard behind the scenes, I swear. Tasha, what about you?
I've also been pretty quiet on Twitter. The Twitter situation is distressing and tiresome, and I've already got enough distressing and tiresome stuff in my life. But, you know, you can always try to engage me over there at Tasha Robinson. I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com, on and off trying to write more in addition to putting more on the site, also working behind the scenes. But you know who I hear you can read a whole lot written by? Keith Phipps. Keith,
that's
how about
right.
you?
Well, I feel like I'm slowing down here at the end of the year, but yes, I'm a freelance writer. I guess I'm still posting my stuff on Twitter. When is this episode coming out? We'll see. We'll see if I'm still there.
Are you on Post or are you on Mastodon and Post and Hive?
What about
I'm
Peach?
Technically on all of them, but I haven't done anything with them. But you know, I write for places like GQ, Vulture, The Ringer, TV Guide, very frequently at The Reveal, which is the newsletter that Scott Tobias and I do. It's thereveal.substack.com. And oh boy, do we have some good stuff coming up. I'll just sort of Scott, let you to him tell you about that. Well, we haven't figured it out yet. Well, Scott, how about you? Scott, where are you writing these days?
Okay, well, the Reveal, of course. Please check it out and subscribe if you enjoy it. And you can find my work on Vulture, Guardian, New York Times, and other fine places. You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. You can find me at Post at Scott_Tobias. You can find me on Hive at Gopher Chambers. See a little twist there. Gopher wow. Chambers is a Silicon Valley reference. If you thought it was a good one, so that's
Scott
find me.
_Tobias already taken?
I think I just decided I wanted to be. No, it was something where I couldn't do the underscore. Hive doesn't let you do the underscore, so it's like, you know what? I'm going with Gopher Chambers. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time. Thank you.